Welcome to the Habit Podcast, conversations with writers about writing. I'm Jonathan Rogers, your host. Scott James is a pediatric infectious disease doctor in Birmingham, Alabama. Besides taking care of children at work and raising four children of his own, he also writes books for children. His most recent book, Where is Wisdom?, is inspired by Job 28, that poem in praise of wisdom that comes right after Job's three frenemies have had their say. It's a gorgeous picture book illustrated by Hein Zaman. We recorded this conversation in the midst of the coronavirus season, so I felt very fortunate that an infectious disease doctor was able to make time to chat. Hey, Scott James, I'm so glad you're on the Habit Podcast today. Thanks for making time for me.
Thank you, Jonathan. I appreciate you having me on.
I know you've been exceedingly busy because you're a physician and an infectious disease physician in Birmingham. Although, as we were discussing a minute ago before we started recording, you're a pediatric physician.
Yeah, pediatric.
Which means you haven't been quite as busy with the pandemic as if you were, say, a geriatric infectious disease person.
Yes. Yes, we've been quite busy, but I'm thankful that so far this virus seems to be sparing children to a certain extent.
Yeah. So you work with children in your day job, and then you write for children. In the last month have released a book about wisdom based on Job 28, and the name of that book is
Where is Wisdom? I stole it right from Scripture.
Yeah, good. That's always safe. Tell us about Job 28. Just remind our listeners what happens in Job 28.
So Job 28 is this. I like to think of it as this oasis in the middle of a really challenging book. So Job is one of my favorite books. I love it in that it's not afraid to ask big questions and really wrestle through a lot of things. And so you're kind of going through Job, and there's these sort of rounds and rounds of conversations where Job and his friends are having these conversations, these really, really hard to follow conversations sometimes. And then in the middle of it, in Job 28, Job responds, he's responding to one of his friends as he's kind of transitioning some in a section of the book. And he just drops this poem down in the middle of these conversations. And it's some Bibles label it a hymn to wisdom. And Job just kind of goes into this very, this language that is full of imagery and like just very vivid pictures. And he starts describing kind of like the ingenuity of man and how good men are at sort of delving into the earth's creations and finding treasures. And he's kind of just talking about how they dig deep and mine silver and gold and grow, you know, plentiful wheat and harvest. And he's just basically talking about how God created this beautiful world and men are really, really talented and ingenious at delving into its treasures. But then he sort of pauses halfway through and he kind of gives this, there's this moment, this self-reflective moment where you can kind of hear him poetically saying, but is that all there is? Like, there's got to be more to this. And that's where he kind of turns the lens and he turns it away from kind of the gifts of creation, and he turns it, turns the camera towards the Creator himself. And he kind of highlights God as the source of all satisfaction and the true treasure. And so he starts kind of highlighting this idea that while we're searching for earthly treasures, there's a bigger treasure to be found in God. And he's using wisdom as kind of the entry point to that. So it's this famous chapter where he starts asking this question, where is wisdom? Where's wisdom found? And so then you go on a treasure hunt looking for wisdom, and no one knows the way. We can't find it. And so ultimately, he ends that chapter kind of looking to God, highlighting God's goodness and creativity, the fact that God is a generous giver, and the fact that God is sovereign overall. And so he kind of concludes with, the end of the chapter concludes with the fear of the Lord. That is wisdom. And so it points ultimately to God. And I just loved how just engaging and creative that chapter is in the middle of that book. And I love that it highlights good things about creation and then and tells us to enjoy them, but also points us to God, asking us to look first and foremost to Him as the kind of our source of wisdom and joy.
Yeah. So, you know, wisdom, it seems to me, and you can, you've written about wisdom for children. I don't have the same experience you do in that. So I want to hear from you. You know, that there, one way to write to children is to simplify things, kind of put them in black and white, to give, you know, to reduce big questions down to easy answers and give them, give those easy answers to children. It's much easier, for instance, to write about morality to children, I think, than it is to write about, say, wisdom, which isn't, I can't remember who I heard saying this recently, but basically, you know, our moral codes don't always give us, they almost never give us easy answers to the hardest questions that we're dealing with. I mean, you were mentioned earlier, again, before we started recording, that you work with the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. And if morality gave us the easy answers to difficult questions, we wouldn't need an ethics commission, right?
Right.
And wisdom somehow lets us make our way in a world that's very complex. How do you, when you're writing for children, how do you deal with that truth?
I think it would be much easier, like you say, if we just had a list of rules to go by. If there was some kind of black and white list of do this, don't do that. If you follow these rules, you will be wise. And yet we know from our experience that there's never going to be an exhaustive enough list of rules. And that's just not the way God intended it to be. So that's just the heart of the gospel. It's less about following rules and it's more about trusting in God. And so when I'm talking with kids, I'm trying to help them think through the fact that wisdom is first and foremost flows out of your relationship with God. So are you looking to God? Are you trusting in God? Are you letting God kind of define who you are and who you see yourself to be? And so in that way, I like to think of wisdom as being nimble. So instead of here's a list of rules to follow and in every situation you find, just consult with this list and do what it says and you'll be wise. That's not reality, right? Because I don't have a verse that tells me how to act in the middle of a global pandemic. I don't have a verse that tells me how to act in all kinds of scenarios in my daily life. And our kids are wise enough at baseline to understand that reality. And so instead, if you just point them to the one who gives wisdom, if you point them to the relationship with God, then you sort of give them that, what I like to think of as kind of a rock solid foundation in knowing and loving and trusting God. And then they can, from that position, they can pivot in whatever direction, whatever life throws their way, they can kind of take those baseline wisdom lessons that they get from God, just from trusting Him and knowing Him, and they can face whatever comes their way. And that's part of the practicality of working out wisdom in daily situations. And so it's not about consulting your list of rules that you keep in your pocket and doing what it says. It's just about just being able to face whatever life throws your way and trusting that God's in control of it. And He's got a plan for it.
What does storytelling have to do with that? I mean, can you sort of close the loop from that idea to storytelling? Given the fact that there's no that you can't make a long enough list.
I think storytelling could be a way to sort of enflesh that and sort of help kids, I don't know, sort of put their imagination through the paces and sort of be thinking proactively about the things that make up our life. And so if we're telling stories, whether we're kind of expounding stories that come from the Bible or just sort of talking about made up stories, if we're just going into that direction with kids, then these can be sort of, training might be the wrong word, but training exercises that are going to help them be sort of thinking through how they're going to encounter their world around them, and giving them like actual sort of vivid examples of, here's a scenario where these characters are going through these issues, and this is a very tough situation for them to be in, and let's look and see how they're evaluating what's around them and responding to it in a way that is or isn't faithful to who God is. Mm-hmm. And so there's, you can get good positive and negative lessons from that, as we know from so much good literature.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And you know, one thing that in good stories, the resolution tends to be something you weren't expecting, right? You've got your ideas about how things are going to work out. And if a story doesn't surprise me, I'm not interested in that story. And when I say it doesn't surprise me, sometimes I like to hear that same story 15 times. So in that sense, it may not surprise me. But if the outworking of that story is exactly what I expected, that's not much of a story. And I do think in that sense, storytelling prepares us for wisdom, because in the world God made, it seems so often that the solution to the problems that are presented to us are upside down solutions. I mean, that kind of is the gospel, right? The solutions we could figure out for ourselves weren't, the saying that they say it in, I think in recovery, AA and things like that, is your best thinking got you here, which is kind of the situation we're all in, is our best thinking got us in the mess we're in. And the, what gets us out of that is grace, which is surprising, but believable. Right? You don't see it coming. And after it comes, you're like, well, of course, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
And that's the way stories work, good stories. But it's also the way the world God made works.
And I think there's this aspect where when you're thinking through the surprise ending and the way that it takes you in a way that you didn't expect it, and that is the mark of a good story. I encourage my kids, I can encourage myself, to when we're encountering a story, a phrase that we use around our house is to like let this basically meet the story on its own terms. Let the story kind of define its context and its direction. And I try to I want my kids to read, the way I phrase it is, I want my kids to read empathetically. So I want them sort of stepping into the story, and rather than just inserting themselves into the story where they say, hey, look, if I were this main character, I would do this. I would act this way. I want them to kind of get in there and then meet the character on his own terms, get to know the world that the character's in, get to know the surroundings and the motivations and the choices that are in front of them, but actually have some empathy to where they're basically sort of immersing themselves into that world and letting the story kind of guide itself. And then I think in the end, they're going to end up learning more about themselves rather than just sort of maybe reading selfishly, where you just sort of insert yourself into the story. And I kind of generally find that when I'm tempted to insert myself in the story, I call it a choose your own ending kind of approach, where I just say, if I were this main character, I would do that. And if they don't act the way that I think they should act, then I get frustrated. And I feel like that's a relatively bad way to encounter a story, and it ends up being less fruitful. And so I want to be surprised by the story. I want to let it go where it's going to go. I want to let it open up my eyes to things that I hadn't previously considered. I want to learn from that character. I want to know who they are and get to know what's motivating them and why they're making that decision. But ultimately, I feel like it's going to be a more fruitful experience for me if I'm actually learning from that character rather than just trying to impose my own beliefs on who he or she is.
Yeah. Which also, by the way, is a better way to live in the world too, in our actual world, and interact with the people there. And so I think what you're talking about here is wisdom, right? Is stories that tell, that help our people live with wisdom. And it's not even a matter of, I mean, I know your book, Where's Wisdom, specifically talks about wisdom head on. Mm. But even stories that don't are still about wisdom. seems to me. Do you, you mentioned telling stories with your kids. How many kids do you have?
We have four kids.
You have four kids, and how old are they?
They're now 8 through 15.
Okay.
Every 2 years.
Do you tell them family stories? Do you spend a lot of time talking about family history?
We do, yeah, a good amount. Yeah, I think we're all over the board with stories. Made up stories, yeah. Factual stories, historical stories, family stories.
Yeah, yeah. I'm always curious enough if people are really sort of telling the family stories.
Yeah, because I think it helps our kids are in this moment in time, and they see the world through the context that they're in, and so what they're experiencing now is, in one sense, all they know to be true. And so my wife and I and their grandparents are continually just, I don't know how conscientious we're doing it, but we're broadening their horizons by telling them about other experiences besides their own. So that's from a different era, whether or not it's, you know, when I was a kid, this is how it was. You know, they're always amazed to learn what it was like to grow up before the internet and things like that. And then hearing their grandparents and my grandmother, their great grandmother, tells them stories of, you know, growing up on the farm in Mississippi. And it's just, yeah, you can see their horizons broadening as they learn to appreciate that which is kind of beyond what they can grasp. So I want to burst the bubble of their little local context. It's a balance, right? I want them to appreciate their local context. Sure. But I want them to know that there's a world outside that. And I think that goes over time, like back through history, but also just geographically, just telling stories from other parts of the world, other cultures. Mm-hmm. So my wife and I traveled a good deal, and are now that our kids are old enough, after this pandemic is over, we're going to continue trying to take our kids places that sort of blow their mind and let them see what life is like outside of their bubble.
Yeah. I can't remember. It was in an earlier episode of this podcast. Somebody was talking about the idea that one definition of identity is finding your role in a story that you didn't write. And you know that we think of in our culture, it has become kind of a truism that you make your own identity, which you just can't really do. You don't, you know, like if you ever try to give yourself a nickname, it never sticks.
That's a good Seinfeld episode.
General. You know, I've always wanted to call it general. Nobody will do that because you can't make up your own nickname. I mean, right. I could, but you know, then there are whole books about people who try to do that. The Great Gatsby, you know, whose real name was what? Stan Gatz or something like that. And gave himself a name, and you know, it almost worked, but it didn't work.
Right.
And I think that's such an important part of story. That's one reason I love family stories is a reminder. There's this story that's been going on, and you have a part in it,
mm-hmm.
Kid.
Yeah.
And you didn't invent the story, but you've got an important part to play in this story.
Yeah. In this here and now, in this family context, but then also telling the stories of God's people generation after generation.
Yeah.
So just making sure that I want my kids to have a vibrant personal faith in Jesus Christ. Like I want them individually to believe and to trust and to identify with Jesus Christ. But I also want them to understand that they're part of a church. They're part of a bigger community, and they're part of a community that has spanned generations. And that's, that means something to have an identity that's defined by the larger purpose.
Yeah.
I love that. Yeah.
That's great. You speak of fostering a biblical imagination through your writing. What do you use that term? What do you mean?
So
imagination.
I think kids, my kids at least, I don't know, I'm sure there's some kids out there that have bad imaginations, but my kids were just born with vivid imaginations and they don't, it's not something they have to work at. I mean, it's just a natural part of their life and day is to encounter the world and encounter their thought process with just this, yeah, these beautifully creative imaginations. And so when I think of biblical imagination, I simply want to harness that and sort of put their imaginations to work for the use of knowing God better and meeting him in his word, listening to scripture. So I don't remember where I first heard the term. I believe Michael Card might've been one of the earlier voices that I heard talking about it.
I could imagine.
He's so great, isn't he? But he makes this cool distinction. I've heard him talk about just how the imagination is this sort of bridge between the head and the heart, the mind and the heart. Mm-hmm. And then he talks about a biblical imagination being basically when you take your imagination and you put it in service to listening to scripture. And so it's this imagination that we have, and yet I want to use it in service to something greater than myself. I want to use it in service to listen to God. And so he kind of puts it at the feet of scripture, and he says, don't abandon your imagination and your creative thought process when you encounter scripture, but use it to dive in all the more deeply. And so I just sort of think through it as for our kids, like when we're reading scripture together or talking about it together, it's simply this concept of like, we don't want to gloss over scripture when we're reading a Bible passage. We don't want to just kind of skim over it superficially. We want to dive deep. But we don't want to helicopter over it analytically. We really want to, step into the scene. And that's where I get this idea of like an empathetic reader, where you really are seeking to understand the person that you're dealing with. So just in personal empathy, it's like if you and I are talking, I want to know Jonathan Rogers. I want to know where you're coming from, what you're feeling, what you're thinking. I want to understand you so that I can love you better. Well, it's the same way if I'm reading a passage in scripture, I want to know ultimately the author, the capital A author, but I also want to know its specific context and the characters that are in that scene. And so it's, you know, put that imagination to use in service of knowing God better through his word. And so for us, it's simply just this idea where we encourage our kids to step into the scene, think what they're thinking, feel what they're feeling, imagine what it must have been like to experience what they're experiencing, walk through that scene, see what they see and feel what they feel. And I think, again, if you kind of approach it in that way, with some hermeneutical tactics in there as well. It's not just a freewheeling, just kind of, hey, how's that passage make you feel? But thinking through it smartly, letting the text kind of put the text in the driver's seat, let it define its own terms and its context and just sort of meet it where it is. That's like contrary to that choose your own ending impulse that I was talking about before, where I just want to make myself the main character of whatever story I'm reading. There's a selfish way to approach scripture like that as well, where you just bring your own presuppositions and you just bring your own preconceived notions to the text. And no matter what that text says, you're going to find something in there that justifies what you already believe. I'd never made this connection before, but you said a good story has a kind of surprise endings. It leads you places that you might not have expected. And I think in the same way, if you come to scripture and you're never surprised and you're never challenged and you never scratch your head and go, wow, like, how does that even work? How does that fit together? I don't understand that. If you're not challenged by scripture in that way, I mean, I think there's a good argument to be made that you might not actually be encountering it on its own terms.
I mean, even with the parables, for instance, we those things are hard to make sense of.
Yeah.
And the fact that we've been to Sunday school all our lives and have some we've had people to maybe salve that confusion before we even really felt the confusion.
And that's Job 28, I think, is a good example of that, because it's the passage, it's one of many passages, they're in Proverbs as well, where it talks about the fear of the Lord. Like, that's the linchpin of Job 28. If we're talking about what wisdom is, it's the fear of the Lord. And I think my whole life, I think every time anyone ever taught me or told me about passages that included the concept of the fear of the Lord, they had to intro the conversation with a bunch of caveats about what it doesn't mean. Well, it doesn't mean fear. It doesn't mean actual fear. You're not supposed to be afraid of God. And they give me all these kind of, we just don't want to take it on its own terms and think, what do you mean the fear of the Lord? Like, I think in a certain way, he means the fear of the Lord. Like, it's like, why not let it mean what it means? Because like, if I'm in rebellion against God, I probably should be afraid. And so yeah, letting scripture kind of define its terms and not necessarily bringing ourselves to bear on it all the time.
Yeah. Hey, one thing I wanted to talk about that we haven't gotten around to, and I want to make sure we get to before we run out of time, the illustrations in your book are just so gorgeous, which you didn't do yourself.
That's, yes, I would.
You just
wrote
the words.
Yes.
And a lot of those you didn't even write. You're telling me. What did you even do in this book, Scott? Tell me about those illustrations.
The illustrations are...
I'm sorry, Heinz Zeman.
Heinz Zeman. He's a young artist illustrator in the Nashville area. Phenomenal. What he brought to this book, this project, how he brought these words to life through his illustrations is, it never ceases to amaze me. And consistently, any feedback I've ever heard from the book, even from my own children, is that the best part of it is the illustrations. And I receive that gladly because it's a very astute observation. The illustrations are phenomenal. They
really are.
Well, especially in the idea that, like, what I'm trying to do is ignite imagination. I want kids to sort of, for the rest of their life, if every single time a kid thought about Job 28, some vibrant illustration that kind of brought it to life in their mind and triggered some remembrance of truth from that passage. If that comes to mind for a long time, then that's a success for me. So I think Hind contributed so much to that.
And Hein was just somebody who had a relationship at B&H, and that's how he ended up on this book?
No, actually, I'm the one who brought Hein to B&H's attention, for this project at least. I became aware of him through the Rabbit Room community, so kind of a mutual acquaintance through Rabbit Room was highlighting his work in another area. He does all kinds of amazing illustrations and graphic design, I was reading a Rabbit Room article one day or something along those lines. I don't remember even specifically what it was. It might have been an article or it was in the forum. I don't remember. But someone from Rabbit Room highlighted his work, and it really just captured my imagination. And so then a year or two later is when I was kind of actually developing this project with B&H. And I said, please check and see if this young man would be available to write to join in this project. And I'm so happy that he was willing and able to join, because I can't imagine it without him now.
Yeah. When you were talking about how happy you would be if you know, a child thinking of, or a grown up who used to be a child, you know, thinks about those pictures, whenever they think about Job 28, I was just thinking about, every now and then I'll run across a picture from the children's Bible I had when I was little, and the amount of I don't know what the word is. I mean, whatever the positive word for baggage is, you know, the freight that contained, it just so much comes back when I see the pictures of whether it's, in any of the my notion of what Noah's Ark looked like came straight out of a children's Bible.
Yep.
No doubt it was historically inaccurate. I don't know, but it was, you know, it's where I have not, until you said that, I hadn't really thought about how much those pictures shaped my biblical imagination.
Yeah. That could be a good thing or a bad thing depending on the picture.
Right. Yeah. Right. Right. I can't even get enough distance from those pictures to say good or bad, you know? Let's see here. I do want to talk a minute about, I've already touched on the fact that you're a pediatrician. How does your work as a pediatrician, or does it shape your work as a writer? Just writing is what you do when you're not pediatrizing?
Well, both are true. it definitely shapes it. And I think it's part of, I think it's more just sort of an outworking of who I am. The way my brain thinks, the way I like to communicate, I was just born to be a pediatrician. And I think I was also wired in a way that makes me enjoy writing for children. So I think they definitely go together in that sense, even though the work is very different. So I write a lot as a scientist. And and I, so I communicate as a pediatrician, I write as a scientist, and I like writing kids' books and stuff as well. And so those are like very, very different things that need to be communicated in different styles. And yet there are some common themes that run through all of them. And it kind of, hopefully it's a common theme for all of us in our lives as we're writing or communicate in any way. And I think first and foremost, it's just respect the reader. So write in such a way that is assuming the best of your audience and assumes that they can grapple with big ideas, and you don't need to talk down to them or condescend. And I think in children's literature, that can be a temptation, right? Like a lot of children's literature kind of has that voice very specifically of talking down or being simplified. So when I'm talking with my patients, I'm trying to get them, right? So if I'm talking one-on-one with a child who's, fighting some illness, I want to make sure that I'm talking with them in a way that they can understand what's going on, to the extent that their little mind is capable. So that's got to be an age-appropriate sort of thing. But I'm communicating big ideas with them.
Yeah.
Just for example, like in my HIV clinics, I'm talking with children or adolescents with HIV. I'm like, that's a huge conversation. That is not a conversation to be taken lightly. And so you've got to communicate that in a way that that sort of expresses the gravity of the situation and what's going on. And you're talking through some really, really big, difficult, life-changing conversations happening there. And yet, if you come across clinical and detached and condescending, then they're not going to hear what you're saying. That's not helpful to them. So you got to be able to engage their heart and talk with them directly to get the proper communication across, but in a way that really lands where it can have an effect on them.
Yeah.
So I'd, like in a different way, that's writing for kids too. Like so if I'm talking about complicated and nuanced concepts like wisdom, I got to be able to communicate that in a way that's biblically faithful and does not try to oversimplify a massive concept, but in a way that actually connects with a child's heart and communicates it in a way that's going to land in a way that they can understand. I want to I think pediatric training and just the way that I interact with patients sort of brings things like that to bear on how I write. I want to respect the reader. I want to not shy away from the big truths. I want to ask hard questions and tackle difficult subjects. And I want to let the Bible speak for itself and contextualize it in a way that kids can understand it in the way that my patients can understand it, if I'm, splitting that analogy.
Right.
But still communicate those big things.
Do you, it's okay if the question is, if the answer is no, but have you given any thought to equipping your young patients as storytellers? In other words, I mean, part of what you have to do is get their story.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have anything to say about that? I'm just curious.
I think so. A lot of traction that I've had with patients and kind of getting them on board with understanding what's going on to them. With the population that I serve, a lot of it is this sort of transition of medical care. So as a patient is growing up, going from childhood to adolescent to adulthood, and at a certain point in there, they have to take responsibility and take ownership of their own health care, and it's no longer mom and dad or foster mom and dad or whoever making their decisions and taking care of them. They need to actually take that responsibility on themselves. And so the storytelling aspect of it, less equipping them to be the storyteller, although I hope that's an outcome of it, but more equipping them to engage the story and understand it and kind of appreciate the fullness of the story.
Uh-huh.
A lot of times, I think people in general, but I do sense it in the younger generation currently, a little bit more prone to compartmentalizing and just saying, here's a thing that I'm dealing with, and here's another thing that I'm dealing with, and just kind of having separate categories that don't always, interrelate in a holistic way.
Yeah.
And so when I'm talking through big concepts like this with patients, I'm trying to paint the big picture for them so that they can see the background of it, the current reality of it, the future prospects of it, And if they can get on board with that whole picture and see their place within that story, then they're more engaged in their own healthcare and taking care of themselves.
That's great. That's one of the ways
that I, maybe the most concrete way, is if I'm talking with a young person who is faced with the decision to take practical steps right now to take care of themselves versus not. And we all face that every day. But I tell younger patients that I basically tell them, like, I'm looking out for 35-year-old you. I think 35-year-old you is going to be an amazing person, and the world needs to see that person. The world needs that person in it doing awesome things. And so I'm trying to get 15-year-old you to make some good decisions right now, so that 35-year-old is able to bless the world like I know she's gonna. And that's a picture. That's a story that I'm casting into the future. And I'm trying to get them to just buy into the fact that they have a future, that there is a place for them in the next chapter of this story. And let's make some decisions right now that are going to help us get there.
Yeah. Wow. We're back to wisdom again.
Always. Hopefully.
Yeah. Hey, I always end these conversations with the question, who are the writers who make you want to write? So that's the question I'm asking you now.
I'm coming at it from a children's author standpoint, and yet I think my honest answer is that reading grown-up stuff makes me want to write for children. So maybe the ending that you expected was the list of children's book authors, of which there are many fantastic ones that inspire me. But I honestly got to say, when it comes to finding inspiration for writing things for my children or for the children of my church or the larger world or community, I love finding writers who are writing not for kids but for adults that have these big concepts that I can try to distill down and communicate clearly and effectively to kids. And so by doing that, it's like my inspiration for children's books are kind of any and all writers that I'm coming across. So like, for instance, John Newton, not typically a children's author person. Right. And yet I love, he's one of my favorite older authors. He's one of the dead guys that I read a lot of. And it's very common that I'll come across some concept or phrase or line or just big idea that he's talking through that makes me want to, like, I want to phrase that in a way or write that in a way. And so I've written stories for my own kids. I've written some stuff that stems from thoughts that John Newton gave me. Uh-huh. Or I think of like big biblical theology books like Greg Beale and Tom Schreiner kind of stuff, and just the way that they weave the whole story together and show the big picture of scripture. I'm just fascinated with kind of trying to help my kids see how it all ties together like that. I simply heard Andrew Peterson explaining something about one of his songs once, and it set me off on a tangent of diving into a particular concept that made me go write a whole book about it as well. And and then the Where's Wisdom that we're talking about today, that simply came from a line from a sermon that my pastor was preaching. So I think those who make me writers that make me want to write, my pastor, Matt Mason, would have to be in there as well. Cause he, when I talk about this biblical imagination and sort of encountering the text and letting your imagination get set on fire, the sermons he writes every week make me do that in my seat every single Sunday.
That's great. Well, Scott, thank you so much for being here. I loved hearing what you had to say, and I love thinking about your holistic way of thinking about all your work and all your life and the ways that writing is just one part of a whole big project of your life. So thanks for sharing that. And sorry your book is coming out at a time that's not great for book releases, but here's hoping and here's praying that good things come from it.
Thanks. I appreciate that. Thanks a lot for the conversation.
The Rabbit Room has partnered with Lipscomb University to make this podcast possible. Lipscomb has graciously given us access to their recording studio in the Center for Entertainment and Arts building. We're so grateful for their sponsorship, their encouragement, and the good work they do in Nashville. Special shout out as well to Jess Ray for letting us use her song Too Good as part of this podcast. Visit jessraymusic.com to hear more of her beautiful songs.
Habit Membership is a library of resources for writers by me, Jonathan Rogers. More importantly, The Habit is a hub of community where like-minded writers gather to discuss their work and give each other a little more courage. Find out more at thehabit.co.
This podcast was produced by The Rabbit Room, where art nourishes community and community nourishes art. All our podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our members. To learn more about us, visit rabbitroom.com. And to become a member, rabbitroom.com/donate.